Hey, Mark, I was listening to Paramore the other day, and it really made me think about the amygdala and the limbic system.
You just made those words up, didn't you?
What, Paramore?
We're the Nevermind the Music podcast, where one musician
and one psychologist
talk songwriting and the mind, one song at a time.
We'll hear everything from Green Day and Outkast
to Stevie Wonder and Dua Lipa.
And we mostly try to stay on topic.
Except for when we don't want to.
Nevermind the Music, wherever you get your podcasts.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.
Welcome to the Silmarillion Stories, where the Lorehound's your guides to Tolkien's world of Middle-earth. I'm David.
I'm John, and this is our podcast for Of Feanor and the Unchaining of Melkor, the eighth story of the Silmarillion.
For this episode, we've got a special guest with us today, Maester Anthony from the Electric Boogaloo podcast. If you've not heard about that podcast, he's covering the entire series of The Song of Ice and Fire by George R.R. Martin, chapter by chapter. We've gotten the opportunity to be on his pod a couple of times. He's been over with us. We talked about Andor, and we've got him today to talk about the Unchaining of Melkor.
In this episode, we're going to be discussing the origins of Feanor, the divisions arising within the Noldor, and the deception of Melkor, before answering some listener feedback questions.
And definitely send us some feedback. We save it up all between the episodes. You can email us to lotr@thelorehounds.com or visit us on our website, where we've got a contact form or the nifty voicemail feature. We've also got a Discord server. There's a link in the show notes. We've got a fun and active community. We've got a dedicated Tolkien channel and channels for all of the other shows that we're covering. So jump in there. Ask us your questions, talk with Marilyn and other folks. It's great. It's a cool place.
All right. And stick around to the end of the podcast for programming notes for the rest of June and a sneak peek at our coverage for July.
So as you may or may not know, we've got a Patreon and we're on a little bit of a membership drive. We would really love to hit 100 subscribers by the end of July, and we'd like to ask your help for that. July 11th is our one-year anniversary, and it would be a huge boon for us to have your support. As you may know, ad revenues are fickle, and the Patreon is really the best way for us to keep growing what we're doing here with this podcast. For subscribers for as little as $3 a month, you get ad-free and early access to all of our podcasts. We have got special live watch events. We've got other exclusive content just for subscribers. And as a thank you to everyone who is a subscriber by the end of July, we're going to send you a special gift in the mail. We've designed a sticker that commemorates our 1 year of podcasting. This won't be available in the store to be able to purchase. It's only for people who are subscribers and who help us get over this. Everyone who is in July, no matter how many subscribers we have, but we just want to thank you, all of our Patreon subscribers. So now that I'm done sounding like an NPR pledge drive, John?
Well, I think it's time to bring in Anthony so we can talk about a Feanor, and as you say, the Unchaining of Melkor.
Unchaining of Melkor.
I'm really excited. I'm really excited, guys.
Cool.
This is one of my... I want you to know before we get going, for my money, Tolkien occupies very rarefied air. I'm thinking, like, of all the storytellers that have been remembered in history, he's probably in the top 10, and he is my favorite. So,
nice.
This book is very meaningful to me. I named both of my children after characters in this book.
Did you?
Yes, I'm a big Tolkien nerd. But in a way that I've sort of kept it pure from academic study. I just returned to it for love and joy. I refuse to taint it with my academic pursuits. So this is really exciting for me to be on the pod.
That's great.
Well, we're excited to have you. I mean, it's funny. We were just talking about Succession on Second Breakfast the other day, and we said maybe we should call Maester Anthony and get a medievalist on this because we are into the medieval politics. And now we get to talk about all the all the crossover with George R. R. Martin, but here with Feanor and Melkor and all this religious stuff that's happening here.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this is a read through where I have read this a few times. David has never read this. Anthony, can you tell us a little bit about your experience with the Silmarillion?
Sure. I mean, I was always told that the Silmarillion is like unreadable, you know, thick mythology. And I was always told that it's like, oh, it's like reading the Old Testament. And so that was always, I always thought, okay, I probably will just stick with Lord of the Rings. And then I realized one day, I was like, I kind of like the Old Testament. Like,
it's got some bangers, some hits.
I kind of like Greek mythology. Why would I deprive myself of reading this book? And so I was probably in my early 20s when I first started reading The Silmarillion. And I remember reading all the way up until Of Beren and Lúthien and just shutting the book and thinking, that was the best story I've ever read. And just ruminating on it for several weeks. In fact, I think it was a month before I went back to like finish the book because I was just so impressed with that chapter. And then, you know, I start reading the next chapter and like, well, of course it's more of their story. Why did I wait? But that, to me, that's still, it's still sort of the, no pun intended, the sort of crown jewel of Tolkien's world, that chapter of Beren and Lúthien. But maybe a close second is the story of Feanor. So I'm really interested in talking about Feanor.
We love Feanor. And if you listen to Reddit, he did nothing wrong. And here's the beginning of his story in earnest.
Yes, that's right.
We've been through the Beguts now. We've gotten through a little bit of the word salad that was the last couple chapters. Uh-huh. And now we're ready to get the plot going a little bit. So why don't we jump right into it after we give general thoughts, because I almost skipped that part. David, it's your first time reading this. Give us your general thoughts.
You know, from the title with the unchaining of Melkor part, which I love to say in a dramatic voice, I was expecting something more dramatic to be happening.
Yes.
And
a very subtle chapter.
It is. Yeah. And my first read through, I got to the end and I was like, whoa, what happened? I just finished the chapter. I wasn't expecting it.
Right.
And then I reread it today. And rather than trying to worry about taking my notes and getting every nuance, I just read it as one would normally. And I started to realize that there is a ton, as you say, Anthony, a ton of subtle stuff going on here.
Yeah.
And there are, especially with Melkor and what he's doing. So it's to me, as the first timer, I could have breezed by this chapter very quickly and just moved on and not thought twice about it. But actually having slowed down a second and read it a second time, there's a lot of groundwork that's being placed here.
That's right.
So it's going to be interesting because you've set up with Feanor that there are troubles ahead, and then Melkor, you know, we think that, oh, you know, well, some people think he's cured of his evil, but really he's not. Dun, dun, dun. Mm. So you can feel the ellipses there setting up for future conflicts.
Yeah. And I think that there's something about this chapter that almost has the dueling banjos thing happening.
Oh, nice. I like that. Yeah.
Because it's pretty clear that the unchaining of Melkor is a huge mistake. Don't do it, you know.
Yeah.
But you could argue that Feanor's origin story has as big of an impact.
Yeah,
it does.
Anything else that happens. And, you know, Tolkien's usually when in comparison with George R. R. Martin, Tolkien's sometimes accused of not writing gray characters. You know, everyone in the book is either good or evil, and it's black and white and, you know, moral absolutes and all that business. But Feanor, to me, is a very interesting, subtle character, not entirely evil, not entirely, you know,
right,
virtuous. Very, I mean, I guess you could look at this chapter and think, oh, well, this is Melkor is the big baddie. But I mean, Feanor might have a bigger impact on the ultimate story.
Feanor, you know, he is a great character, like you're saying. And I think that Tolkien was treating him more as a tragic character than as a villain.
Mm-hmm.
Because he has this whole thing about losing his mother, which clearly pulls from Tolkien's own life, losing his mother at a young age and feeling lost, I think, without her. And you see that at the end, I don't remember if they mentioned this in this chapter, but I know it's been mentioned before. Feanor is going to come back at the end of time, mm-hmm, and do the right thing. So we know that Tolkien wants him to have a sort of redemption arc in the end.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that Tolkien treats him more as a tragic character than a villain. He clearly did a lot wrong, Reddit aside, but he, I think, largely was led down that path through grief and pain.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And something else that stuck out to me this chapter is just how cyclical it is. With the Sauron stuff in the Second Age, I mean, you have Melkor sort of befriending the elves and being all, oh, I'll help you, I'll teach you my ways, and I'm really your friend. And it just screams what Sauron was doing in the Second Age. You can see echoes of that, you know, Sauron learned from him. And it's just funny how the whole evil empire in Tolkien has the same playbook, no matter who it is.
Yeah, I kind of, when I was first rereading this in preparation, I was thinking this little chapter is kind of the blueprint for a lot of other bigger stories that happen over the course of several books. And one of the things that occurs to me is that you almost have a repeat of the creation narrative. Because, I mean, you know, the creation narrative is this great harmony. And of course, one of the voices of the Ainur decides to do his own thing.
Right.
And discord is created. And you almost have that with Feanor in this chapter as well. You know, he wants to do his own thing. He's absolutely intent on kind of pouring himself into his craft, and it really does cause a discord. You know, he does this at the expense of the relationships in his life. So that sort of is a repeat of that particular theme. In addition to that, you have this theme that bleeds into Lord of the Rings, where Tolkien is very suspicious of these geniuses who craft these great works of, I would say, mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
Tolkien is very suspicious of anyone who's crafting anything that's not natural.
Yeah, Marilyn Pukila would call it the machine. That's how Tolkien is referred to it in his writings.
Yeah, so in Lord of the Rings, it's like, well, weapons of war are clearly created by bad people for bad purposes. But even during the scouring of the Shire, you almost get a view of his critique on what's happening in Northern England with the kinds of houses that are going up that just, you know, very standard brick boxes that are just a blight on the landscape.
Right.
And So I think throughout you'll find that Tolkien is very suspicious of the kind of genius that leads to invention. Mm-hmm. And I think he's also almost suspicious of his own genius. I think he's worried about, I think that he views his role as a creator of a world as being almost, of having godlike power.
Yeah. It's almost heretical to him.
Yes. And right. it is absolutely something that he feels uncomfortable with, mm-hmm. both because of his Catholicism and for other reasons. One could say that the entire story of, Lord of the Rings is that power will corrupt you. And so you have to cast out power wherever possible. And embrace love or devotion or loyalty or something else. But if you're driven by, you know, the need to grasp power, you'll mm-hmm. lose yourself.
And the need to dominate, especially.
That's right. And in this chapter, we have basically the elves coming up with a written script. We have Fëanor deciding to craft these things of immense beauty that are not evil. I don't think that the Silmarils are evil.
But
it's the ambition that leads to their creation that Tolkien is suspicious of and wants to critique. And I think in that way, you could almost say that Fëanor is like the anti-Hobbit. You know, here is someone who's brilliant. He's driven. Mm-hmm. He's just genius, and he's ambitious. If nothing else, he's ambitious. And this is exactly what leads him astray. Whereas sort of then when you get introduced to the hobbits later on, they almost have zero ambition. Yeah. And this becomes kind of their superpower. So I think that, I mean, maybe you should say the other way around. Maybe it should be like Bilbo is the anti-Fëanor you know, something like that. Because Fëanor is really the epitome. He's like the archetype of the ambitious genius.
Yeah. And quite a Da Vinci of mm-hmm. his time. I mean, he's got the Silmarils. He's also developing a writing system, I guess refining it, but still, he's doing quite a lot in his days. He's a busy boy. Mm-hmm. Why don't we get a little bit into the plot while we talk about this? I'm just going to read off the first one so that we can discuss. Finwë, king of the Noldor, has a child with his wife Miriel, who gives the energy required to produce several children to making Fëanor. Miriel becomes a shadow of her former self and her spirit leaves her body. So this is what I'm talking about with Tolkien really putting his own life experience in here, you know, losing his mother at a young age, feeling like, you know, his mother, I believe, homeschooled them, was very into his mother taught him several languages. That was his like bonding experience with his mother was learning ancient languages and doing that kind of thing. And I think he really saw her as his muse, as the one who gave him everything he had, all of his intellectual curiosity. And so I really think he's writing Miriel as this person who gave everything to her son.
Yeah.
And it's very sad to think of it that way, but I think it's right.
Well, and also with that one, I'll let you continue with the plot here, but that particular point was reminiscent of, to me, when Sauron pours all of his, almost his being or his essence into the One Ring.
Mm-hmm.
Tolkien has this thing sometimes where if you pour something of yourself into the creation,
mm-hmm.
you no longer possess it. It no longer belongs to you. And it's almost like when Sauron does this with the One Ring, he loses something integral to him. It's not like it's a zero. It is a zero sum game. It's not like he just can just throw his creativity in the world and create things and have it had no expense on his soul or something.
Yeah.
I got the sense with Feanor's mother that there was something similar that happened. Like she, like so much of her went into her son that there was no, that there was not enough left for her.
Right.
I really got the sense that there's almost a parallel there.
For strength that would have nourished the life of many has gone forth into Feanor.
Yeah.
Interesting. So this goes into this concept that Tolkien fleshed out in side writings that didn't really make it into the Silmarillion, called the Hroa and the Fea, and that's body and spirit. And these are two things that pretty much every being's got, but they operate differently in the beings, you know. Humans are basically all Hroa with a little Fea. Elves are almost all Fea with some Hroa. And the elvish Hroa, which is, again, the body. So I'm just going to say body and spirit now, because otherwise we're going to get all confused. But the elvish body energy is what they expend to create children. You know, they have to, in order for them to create, they have to expend this energy. And that's why, you know, they're limited in, like, you know, Feanor can only create the Silmarils once. Miriel can only create a certain amount of children, or one if she's going to make a superpowered kid, apparently. And this is something that naturally fades over time as well. That's sort of the elvish version of aging, is this body energy fades over time. Sauron, on the other hand, is one of the Maiar, so he's not going to fade naturally. So him pouring all his energy into something is deeply unnatural. But I like your analogy, and I like how you're sort of linking the consequences there.
Well, in addition to that, we have this notion with Gandalf that he doesn't just have this unlimited supply of fire magic.
Right.
You know, if he'll get drained, you know, if he can light a pine cone on fire or whatever. But if he wants to do anything more than that, there's going to be a consequence to that.
Yeah. He's also he's been a little nerfed by the Valar too, by making him an Istar. And he's like, don't play with fire. Don't do anything you don't need to. It's sure. It's very, they're all, the Valar are so skittish by the third age. They don't even know what instructions to give.
I think we should call out also that there is a bit of sort of Tolkien's old school, I guess, chauvinism that goes into this.
Okay.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, like every now and again, he'll write a really interesting female character, but I mean, what are the females doing in this chapter? You know, they're good at needlepoint. Right. They're good at homeschooling. They're kind of like Feanor's wife, I think, holds his creative energy in check so he doesn't go too crazy.
Except I will say one thing that I really liked about Nerdanel, which is Feanor's wife, is it says that she's the only one Feanor would ever go to for counsel. Right.
And it does call her wise. Right.
Right. Right. And she's tempering. She's the daughter of his master, of the smith that taught him. And so I think he sort of imputes some of that respect to her. And then
there's no doubt about that. And I would never call Tolkien a misogynist or something. I just think
he's got a little going on because he was, you know, born in 18 something.
Yeah. I never go too far down this path because the book means too much for me to sort of critique it on that level. But it's pretty clear that the women in this story are sort of props for the men.
Yeah.
Well, in this line I love about Mariel, and after his birth, she yearned for release from the labor of living. You know, it's very dramatic. It's very you know, the languaging of it is.
Well,
you know,
and I think, yes.
Oh, I'm so heavy. I'm weary of spirit. I must rest.
And I think that probably does. I don't want to do too much psychoanalysis, but I mean, if you think about Tolkien's world, you know, who were the women in his life, and you know, how did they function for him in his world? You know, you mentioned his mother earlier, and you know, so I mean, I think a lot of sort of his worlds was shaped, his worldview was shaped by these male friendships and these male war companions and male students at Oxford, you know, that he was sort of living in a world of men, and I don't think he actually ever met a woman he understood.
Right.
I just don't know. I don't know that he ever had. Maybe he was just super awkward and he never figured it out.
Well, I was just listening to the That's What I'm Talking About podcast with Mary Clay, uh-huh. who we've had on. And she just had Marilyn on, and they were they did a podcast on the friendship between Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe fellow, C.S. Lewis.
Lewis.
Yeah, between C.S. Lewis and Tolkien. And so they talked a lot about that society of fellows. And one thing that was really interesting was that wherever Tolkien went, he seemed to form a club or join into a club of other dudes. And it was all of this clubby, chummy stuff, you know, from, before the war, during the war, after the war.
Yeah.
It was always a society of fellows. And they would form these organizational units to discuss topics, to exchange views, to preview their art, whatever their art may be. And it was really those bonds, those literal fellowship, as in male gendered fellowship bonds, that were constant and present in his life.
Yeah, that's right. And he's an academic, and that was a world of men.
It
was
until
very, very recently, that was a world of men. So
it's true.
Anyway, I don't want to critique too harshly on this point, but I did note that, okay, mother, wife,
mother again.
He's not happy with the stepmother. It was interesting to have the kind of the stepmother plot.
Yes. Yeah. So speaking of stepmothers, Finwë remarries to Indis of the Vanyar and has two more children with her named Fingolfin and Finarfin, which are not antidepressants, but instead elves. Other elves comment that this was a poor decision, but the narration suggests Spibimi is in play. Are you familiar with Spibimi, Anthony?
Not until I reread this chapter, I'll be honest.
It's shall prove but mine instrument. That is something from the Music of the Ainur, and it's where it's from the Prancing Pony podcast. They've shortened it to Spibimi. But Marilyn brought it into our world, and now we're running with it. And
yeah, I've been pretty I've been a pretty faithful listener to this podcast.
So
probably how I learned it.
Yeah, it's it's if you're listening in the audience and you don't know it, it's when Eru Arugula, we call him Eru Arugula sometimes, when Eru Iluvatar is talking to Melkor and like, hey, you think you can. You can just do evil? Well, anything you do that's evil will prove but mine instrument, shall prove but mine instrument, Spibimi. And so it's basically, I'm going to turn all your evil to good.
Right.
So that seems to be the vibe with these half Noldor, half Vanyar children.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So, yes. All right. I did like, I mean, there's a very, very old retold story about the problems with the second wife. This goes back to, you know, Babylon. This goes back to, you know, Hebrew Bible. Second wives in general in old stories are a problem, because not just because of who they are and what they mean for the children, but because the half brothers might not get along, and there also may be a question of inheritance. And so I think here Tolkien's playing with this old story that there's generally strife between brothers, and even more so if they are not if they're half brothers,
right?
And so this is sort of, this becomes this major rift. This becomes one of the big points of tension over the course of the next 300 pages.
Yeah, and you know, the Vanyar we're learning in this chapter, and it's been discussed in a few chapters. They're kind of just vibing in Valinor. You know, they are so happy just being there, basking in the light of the trees, weaving baskets, and whatever else they're doing. You know, just random crafts, and they're not really interested in the political game. And so I think that some of that rubs off on Fingolfin, Finarfin, and their children, which is adding additional tension to them, between them and the Feanorians, because the Feanorians are super political and all vying for power all the time, and they just can't understand that anyone else would not be as hungry for power as them.
Yeah, this chapter begins that it is noontime. It is the noontide of the Blessed Realm. And of course, you know, you read that and you're like, oh, it's, you know, everything's going great. This can't end well, right? Yeah. In order for this to be a story, it's not going to be noontide for very long.
Right there in that construction, Tolkien sets us up for, well, if it's noon now, in a few hours, it's not going to be. And that's that right. means something different. Yeah.
And of course,
really nice construction.
We're like three remakings of the world in already. And right. there's still plenty of conflict to come.
Right.
And so here we are. But I'll remind listeners, if you're not familiar, the houses of Fingolfin and Finarfin are tremendously influential. The House of Finarfin yields Galadriel and Finrod. So you've got plenty of good lineage going on there. So I think that's part of Galadriel was clearly a favorite character of Tolkien. And I think he would have worked her into the Silmarillion more if he had had more time to write it, but he didn't. But I think that this is part of him saying, well, you wouldn't have gotten Galadriel if I didn't write in this second mom here.
Right. Interesting.
So Feanor, we learn, is the greatest of smiths and learns to create jewels greater than those found in the earth. Again, you know, the machine getting something that's not quite natural. And he also refines the system of writing we mentioned. Now, one of the sets of jewels that he wants to make is the Silmarils out of the light of the trees.
Mm-hmm.
The whole concept of the Silmarils, how do we feel about that?
I don't know how to place the Silmarils because we see a lot of derivative work from Tolkien, you know, setting up narrative structure, the trilogy, I guess you could say, you know, this obsession around having, you know, all these trilogy stories, lots of other things, but these jewels that held the light of the trees, this is something that has always seemed to me very uniquely Tolkien, and I don't know where he pulled from other mythologies, or, you know, and this idea of capturing the light of the trees in these jewels, and then having these jewels be this object that causes all of this strife and conflict. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've never known how to contextualize them by placing them next to or around other stories and literature, and so for me they've just always been singular, and I don't know what else to think about.
Anthony, when you first read the Silmarillion, what was your impression of the Silmarils, and how has that changed over time?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've usually read them as, it's almost like not just an artifact from paradise. It's almost
really like interesting.
A relic that has a power. You know, there's something about like the power that used to charge the universe is the only thing that is left over from those days, from sort of the Garden of Eden, is this relic. And so that's what gives it value, because it's the only thing left of something that we're never going to get back.
Right.
Right.
A talisman in some
way. Yeah, but almost like the archetype of that. I mean, I think of the Arkenstone as sort of a, almost a,
everybody wanted it to be a Silmaril. But sadly not.
but it is a type of Silmaril in the way that it functions for the story, because it's the heart of the mountain.
Right.
It's not just a fancy jewel that looks cool and everyone wants it because it's valuable. It's something that is that has almost cosmic power.
Yeah.
And it has the ability to sort of turn the heart of the person who wants it. The thing that I always found that was just the most fascinating thing to me about the Silmarils is that Melkor wants them, devises this 1,000-year-long plot to get them, gets them, and as he possesses them, they burn him.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
And even he puts them in a crown and he wears it on his head, and it's always causing him pain. But they're so valuable and he wants them so badly that he just suffers through it. Maybe I was a young man when I read it, so maybe I hadn't read a lot of other things, but to me that always stuck to me as something unique and brilliant about these things.
Yeah.
Is that there's something that you need, you cannot help but possess it, even though you know that they're going to hurt you. And in that way, I thought there's a little bit of the ring in the Silmarils too.
Yeah. Mm. You know, it's not that it's the holy light that's just hurting everybody. It's also just that it's the desire to possess and hoard the holiness and possess and hoard the goodness of the Silmarils that ends up hurting people and that ends up causing all these wars and conflicts that plague the rest of this book.
Mm.
And when you see other characters choose to free themselves from that, choose to offer it willingly, choose to do the right thing with it, they are generally rewarded. Maybe Arondil got a weird reward, but other than that, I think they're generally rewarded for not trying to hoard the Silmarils.
Isn't the light of the trees a proxy for the light of God or the...
It's made by the Valar.
Right.
It's not even
Iluvatar's fire.
No. So this is made, you know, we talked about the trees. This was made by a combination of Valar. So, right. But this, you know, it's all the same cosmic energy, I would say. And this, they're pouring their cosmic energy into the trees. They can only do it once because we're talking about, you know, you have a limited amount of sub-creation energy.
Right.
And that's the one shot you got is to make these trees. Feanor also only has one shot to make the Silmarils. So everybody's got sort of a limit to their creation power. But this is actually made from the holiness of that tree, whereas all the trees that come after this are based on an imitation of the two trees.
Right. Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. Feanor, speaking of, he married Nerdanel, who has a tempering presence on him. Feanor and Nerdanel had 7 sons, which is an unusually high number, and it shows sort of how great his presence was. The 7 sons of Feanor, we didn't go for 12. Tolkien didn't go full biblical, but he did go quite a bit.
He went musical.
He went musical with it. There you go. What's noted too is that Nerdanel imparted her sort of temperance to some of them. So some of them are going to be a little calmer, and some of them are going to be fiery like Feanor. I almost think of, you know, it's funny, they put Feanor and Nerdanel together. It almost feels like he's the forge and she's the tongs, right? And she's the cooling water. They're sort of part of the same forging process of making these children, and some of them come out a little more one way and a little more the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what is it? It says here, Nerdanel? I'm sorry.
Nerdanel.
Nerdanel, thank you. I knew
Nerdanel, I'm sorry.
Nerdanel.
You're messing me up now.
Oh, yes, I'm good at that. It also was a firm of will, but more patient than Feanor, desiring to understand minds rather than to master them. I thought that was an interesting line there. She was interested in understanding and empathy, as opposed to, you know, dominating and and directing.
Well, we have a question in feedback, and I'll go more into detail there, but we have a question in feedback about elvish magic and how it works. And to my understanding, Tolkien's vibe with elven magic was not that they're really creating something generally and not that they're really fundamentally changing the universe. It's that they are understanding the way the world works and working with it, not against it, not changing it into any shape, sort of you know, singing to the waters, you know, really like lulling these things into working with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that that's more of what Nerdanel is doing in contrast to Feanor, who is hammering that stone, that Silmaril together.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that there's an idea in Tolkien's work that as a craftsman, you can enhance the properties that are already present. And in other words, sort of bring out the essence of something. So in other words, you're not really creating it. You're coaxing it to do,
right,
to do what it might, you know, something that it might not have done yet. Or there is the tendency to distort, right? So, you know, the creation of orcs, for instance, is a distortative power.
Mm-hmm. Right?
You're taking something and you're making it less than its original intention.
Right.
So are you working with Iluvatar or are you working against Iluvatar? I think Tolkien would think of it in those terms.
Right. And Nerdanel, you know, I noted that she's the only one that Feanor really went to for guidance. I love this quote about Feanor, though. Few ever changed his courses by counsel, none by force.
Yeah.
So yeah. You not mess with this guy, you're not gonna convince him otherwise.
Yeah, you get the sense that, you know, he's a craftsman. He's known for being like the ultimate smith. But in that line, you almost like he's kind of a badass too, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't mess with this guy.
You ever see the art of him? He's got the long flowing hair and he's just ready to kick ass.
I don't think I've ever seen an image of Feanor that really captures the image that I have in my mind.
Okay.
Same with Tolkas. I for some reason I always picture them differently, and I've never seen an artist sort of put what's in my head on a page.
Tolkas, I always picture as riding in going, ha ha, the hunt is on, you know, just very, very, I don't know. I don't know how to describe it.
Braids, yeah, you're right. Flowing,
it's hard to do it. Yeah.
Very muscle bound.
Yeah.
Tolkas is also a character in this chapter.
He is.
He gets to seethe a little bit.
Yeah. So around this time, Melkor's sentence runs out. He sues for pardon and it's granted to him. Nienna helps Melkor in this, but Ulmo and Tolkas remain suspicious. But they do not rebel. And we get Tolkien moralizing a little bit here. He goes, those who will defend authority against rebellion must not themselves rebel.
Yeah.
Very after school special, Mr. Tolkien.
So, you know, in a Kindle, I was reading this on my Kindle, and I've noticed this in some places, that if there's a passage that is highlighted by a lot of people, it says, so I've got this little dotted line under that phrase and it says 1,825 highlighters. So 1,800 other people have highlighted this thing.
And I
wonder sometimes too, like, is there a waiting going on here? Well, everybody else highlighted it, so I have to highlight it. So now,
absolutely. Oh, this must be an important quote.
Exactly. But I found that it was funny that that line got one of these, bonus highlights. It's a very relevant statement. It has some potency in our modern political conversation right now, and our an experiment in democracy.
Yeah, it's interesting. And Tolkas like won't even be in the same room as Melkor, right? He's like, don't come at me, bro. It's basically Tolkas's energy.
Yeah, Tolkas. And there's another line about him that is. His wrath is slow to kindle, but even so, he's also slow to forgive or something like that.
Right. He's slow to forget, I think. Yeah. Interesting. He's once you get on Tolkas's bad side, you're not getting out of it.
Yeah. He's slow to wrath.
Been three ages, Tolkas.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what is that to an immortal being, you know?
Uh-huh.
You know? And to be fair, I mean, we've been making the case against Manwë for quite a while now. I think it's debatable, this one. I'm not prepared to say this was a fully bad decision to let Melkor go. Maybe it was a bad decision to set him all the way free right away.
Uh-huh.
But he did promise a sentence, and is he better than Melkor if he doesn't stay by his word? That's a question. However,
I was talking about this with my wife last night. This whole concept, I think it's almost a Shakespearean concept, that if you are the king who is truly innocent of evil will not be able to perceive evil or something.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Macbeth. Yeah, that's from Macbeth. Yeah.
Okay, good. I was saying Hamlet last night, but I
free from evil and could not comprehend it is the line in the book.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really interesting.
She was like, well, he's just naive. And I think, yeah, I don't know. I mean, there is something about that that's true. I mean, there are certain things that it's almost impossible to be free of evil, but if you were to be free of evil, what would that look like? What would it look like? A weakness. And I think for Manwë, it is a weakness.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he should have been a little bit dirty.
Right.
If he had been a little bit dirty, he might have been able to see what was going on. But there's a parallel here, of course. Because Sauron can't conceive that the Fellowship of the Ring would want to destroy it.
Right, right.
Because it's like the last thing that to occur to him that the Lord of the Ring wouldn't want to possess it.
And right. And knowing that is the case, he then has control, because once you put that ring on, you're mine. Yeah, I own you. Yeah.
And that's his ultimate weakness, because he cannot conceive of a different strategy.
Yeah. To finish this thought about him not being able to comprehend evil, the line, the rest of the paragraph goes, in the thought of Ilúvatar, Melkor had been even as he, right? So they were, you know, Melkor was supposed to be sort of on par with him. And he saw not to the depths of Melkor's heart and did not perceive that all love had departed from him forever. So, yeah, I think it's just buttressing your point there, Anthony, that there is no concept here, because it just, there's right. there's a belief in an absoluteness in something. And he's got Ilúvatar's song in his head.
Mm.
And he can't see beyond that pattern or that song of the original source.
And Melkor and Manwë were the only two Valar to receive a piece of every piece of Ilúvatar's
mind.
Just a little bit, just a little bit was hidden of like the children and whatnot. But as far as things that the Valar got, each one got a different piece, but Manwë and Melkor got the whole pie.
Right, right.
I love this. I love the idea that Tolkien is actually subtle criticism. I think it's very subtle, but Tolkien gets criticized for imagining a utopia because the right guy is on the throne. Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you just get the right king on the throne,
he was a little bit of a royalist. Yep.
Yeah. Everything will be perfect. Cool. Right?
Right.
But even then, I mean, Manwë is absolutely the epitome of this. Right. He's like the archetypal king figure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he knows the mind of God. He's innocent to it. You know, he's pure. Yeah. You know, he's wise. And yet, even so, that perfect archetypal king has a weakness that ends up wreaking havoc on Middle Earth, basically.
Right.
Kind of like Paddy Cosnatine's character in
yeah, that's right. No, the House of the Dragon. He's almost intentionally blind to the weaknesses of his family, right?
Yeah,
but I think it's interesting here that it's very subtle, but I do think that he's criticizing this mythology that people almost attribute to him.
Yeah.
I don't think he's, I think that he's a little bit more subtle than that.
Yeah. Well, you see the Valar get more cautious through the Second Age and then the Third Age. They do have to learn from their mistakes, because I think Tolkien would have said the Valar failed to properly combat Morgoth forever. Until the very end when they finally decided to, you know, rip off the Band-Aid and send him out to the void.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when we do the case against Manwë, I do think Manwë is largely a very flawed leader, especially early in the First Age.
I think you're right. I do think that there's something about Tolkien's view of what to do with evil. It's not as easy as just to eradicate it.
Yeah.
You know, he refuses to say that that was the right thing to do with Gollum, for instance.
Right.
Right. It's like, you don't know his story. And Frodo, I wouldn't be so quick to take away life if you can't give life.
Right.
And I think that there's something here like, what would you do with Melkor? I mean, the easy sort of answer would be like, well, just eradicate him. But he's an immortal being. So,
right.
I don't know that.
Have him chained, though, right? Like, they had him contained. He couldn't break out. We know that. He stayed there for 3 ages. He definitely would have, could have.
It's interesting because that theme that plays in some superhero stuff in MCU, there's definitely themes of that. Even Walking Dead had that with Harry Dean or whatever his name. What was his character's name? With the baseball bat.
Yeah.
And they were like, How are we going to, you know, deal with him? And they built a jail cell. And then what did that do? And then you had this
Negan.
That's it. Thank you. You know, you had this guy whispering to people in the, you know, from the basement, right? Uh-huh. Like, stay, you know, if you thought about this, if you thought about that. So yeah, what do you do with Melkor?
Right. What do we think about Nienna? And, you know, she's the Vala of grieving. How do we feel about her helping Melkor sue for pardon, helping him pray for mercy, basically.
When I read that line, so Marilyn is a big Nienna stan, mm-hmm. and I instantly thought, well, I gotta find out from Marilyn what she thinks of.
She'll write in right after this.
Oh yeah, she'll hear this, yeah. And we'll get an email straight away. So yeah, it left me real scratching my head, going, what is going on here with Nienna? And
I have a good friend who's a lawyer, and I was teaching an ethics class, and I had him come talk to our ethics class, and one of the students said, now he's not my friend's not a criminal lawyer, but he gave a good answer to this. One of my students was saying something like, how can anyone defend someone that who has done, you know, these unspeakable evils?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And my friend said that at the end of the day, when the entire world is against you, at least one person should be for you.
Mm. Mm.
And I thought that was a good answer. You know, of course, I think that, you know, the job of the lawyer is a little bit different than the job of the goddess of grief or whatever. but there is something to be said for, like, that sort of counselor person that's like, I'm going to be the one person in your life who's not going to judge you for the worst thing you did. I'm going to be someone else to you.
Mm. Right.
So I kind of like that. Like I said, these are great characters. I really think that these are hard questions.
Yeah. I was just thinking, I have two thoughts. We just finished, we've just wrapped on Ted Lasso. And one of the things that we talked about is the Nate and Ted storyline and forgiveness. And when you forgive somebody, you're doing it not for them, but you're doing it for yourself so that you're giving yourself some relief and some space. Mm. You're not carrying around this sort of poison, this chalice of poison inside of you and keeping you angry and ruining all the other relationships and things that you have going on in your life. But it also does something that it gives that person who you've had this conflict and who has done you some wrong, it gives them space to experience grace. And if there is a space, because if there's a wall there, mm-hmm. I hate you and I'll never mm-hmm. forgive you, then now you have persistence. And, you know, resistance and persistence, you've mm-hmm. got two forces pushing against each other.
You've sort of got no choice but to resist, right? If you exactly. have no If you have no way of moving forward, you're going to move backwards.
So then suddenly you have this space to move forward into, and you can then choose to take that step or not take that step. Whatever, that's on you, right? That's your responsibility. So I've got that thought running in my head, and then I've got this other thought of yeah, as you say, in the criminal justice world, my sister was worked in family courts in family law. But around this stuff where they were constantly wrestling with these questions of, you know, between parents and care providers and social workers and the courts and the police and all of this stuff. And unless you've got somebody advocating for you inside of that system, the state has a terrible amount of power. And when the state decides to focus on you, it is a huge, huge thing. And so you've got to have somebody who is checking that power structure and making sure that the T's are being crossed and the I's are being dotted and that. And the only way you can do that, there may be other ways to do that, at least in our system, is to have the adversarial system of the defense attorney.
So another way to look at this is, I mean, it's pretty easy for us, sort of, we've got sort of a God's eye view on this. And of course, we know Melkor is the you know, ultimate the black rule. Enemy or whatever, right?
Right.
But what would be the greater sin to keep Melkor chained up, believing that he's rehabilitated?
Mm-hmm.
Or allowing him to go free, knowing that he's still going to wreak havoc.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on if you're going to do a retributivist view of justice or a utilitarian view of justice. Because if you go utilitarian, of course you should keep him chained up. It's one being versus all of the beings in this world.
Yeah, yeah.
Who's going to suffer more? That's
right.
Tricky.
Yeah, I guess.
And then
I guess
retributive is like, does he deserve it? I don't know.
I guess the other way to think about this, I mean, the analog here, of course, is it a greater evil to let a guilty man go free,
mm-hmm.
or
mm-hmm.
to keep an innocent man imprisoned?
Right. Right.
Because Melkor doesn't let his mind be known, and he's pretty good at deceiving people.
Right.
You know, there's a few people who aren't deceived, but almost everyone else is deceived, right?
Right.
And
deceived to the point of they're enamored. Wow, this guy knows a lot and he can help us.
And he's helping them. From us. You know, he's helping them. He's cool. Doing the catch me if you can thing where, you know, DiCaprio is still kind of a con artist, but now he's working for the good guys. You know?
Right.
He kind of comes across in that way.
That is a good movie, by the way.
It's really a great movie.
Yeah.
And it's one of these times where it's like, if I'm Manway, what do I think the greater evil is? I think in my view, I think, well, if he's still got deception in him, if he's still got, you know, greed and narcissism, and if he still wants to wreak havoc, I'll just send Tulkas out there and round him up again.
Box around.
We did it before. We'll do it again. We'll just. You know, I do think that there's something about this that looks like Manway's being naive, but at the end of the day, it's not that easy of a decision.
No, I totally agree. I've mostly just been raising the question so that we could have an interesting conversation.
So, but then that goes back to, if you're going to be of your word and honorable and these things, and we said we're going to put you away for 3 lifetimes, you've served your 3 lifetime sentences. Yeah, yeah. We can't go back on that and not be you.
Yeah.
And not be against the values that we state. And then it's you've served your time, you're released. Isn't a lot of Tolkien's writing hinge on this free will question and having agency and choice in your life? I know there's a tension there.
Kind of. It's a little determinist too sometimes, but
at times, right? But then also free will is a big part of it. So
in Tolkien is basically, are you gonna save your soul or not? Mm. I think Tolkien would say Eru's plan, which is God's plan in his eye.
Right.
Eru's plan is gonna happen whether you like it or not. The only thing you have choice over is, are you going to be part of it and go to the good place, or are you going to not be part of it and oppose it and then go to the bad place?
But important thing is that you have that choice, that you've got to be able to make that choice. And so if we can't give Melkor the choice to be good or be evil, then are we denying his agency? And how does that jive with our values?
I'm going to bring in Nienna again and just sort of where she's at as this goddess of grief, right? Nienna, I think more than any other Vala in the Tolkien universe, knows how something terrible can be for the good in the end. Spibimi, she's the epitome of Spibimi, right? I'm grieving something, but I'm going to learn from this, and I'm going to heal from it, and I'm going to have a deeper connection and a deeper emotional connection because of it. And I think that makes her say, and also, you know, we know that she teaches patience to Gandalf, right? She's exceedingly patient. That's one of her characteristics. I think she would say, you know, maybe he is still going to be evil, but I trust that if we continue to do the right thing, like letting him out when we said we were going to, and then policing where we need to, that good will win out in the end. It shall prove to be but Eru's instrument, and it'll work out because we did not sink to his level.
Yeah, right.
Mm. And so that's where I'm sort of bringing in the grief part is maybe this is going to be a terrible thing. Maybe he is going to destroy everything, but we'll take that grief and we'll make something beautiful with it.
I guess what I'm thinking, I'm struggling with how to talk about the problem of transcendence. You know, Manwë's a sky god, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And most of these gods are just out of the picture, you know? You know, sort of this is all sort of trying to set the groundwork for, you know, the War of the Ring, right? And eventually they're going to fade away, you know? These deities are going to stop being active agents in the world.
Right.
And sort of leave it to the elves and men to try to do the kind of thing that you're talking about. And then of course, then the elves are going to recede from the world and leave it to the men. Right.
And then the men will leave it for the hobbits, and the hobbits will leave it for the, I don't know.
No, the hobbits do it. The hobbits get right?
We can stop at hobbits, everyone.
So there is something about the fact that the design has already been finished, and now you little person with little hands and little decisions, what are you going to do with the time you have, right?
Mm-hmm.
You may be a fleeting blip on this large scope story, but you might make a tiny little decision with your life that can change the course of a war. I think that Tolkien really is attracted to that kind of story.
Yeah. I think that's right.
Fascinating stuff.
Yeah. One more plot point to get through before we let you go, Anthony. Melkor becomes jealous of the elves and plots against them while pretending to aid them. The Vanyar are disinterested. The Teleri are dismissed by Melkor, but Melkor goes a little Goldilocks and he finds that the Noldor are welcoming to Melkor. They're just right in the middle. They're interested. They're not dismissive. And he's interested in them, and they're interested in his teachings, but Fëanor is not interested in Melkor, we learn. And there's a great statement, I believe, that it says, you know, some people might say that Melkor helped Fëanor, but really Fëanor was not a big fan of Melkor, you know, that was all his doing.
This is all elven propaganda.
It is. It's Noldor.
Melkor designed the Silmarils, but the story that we've been told through the Elven spin machine is that Fëanor had nothing to do with it.
Yep. Yeah. So Feanor being opposed to Melkor right away, it's funny because it's almost, I think, that two people who are super prideful, it's almost like two people who want to be like alpha dog, not mm-hmm. getting along,
mm-hmm.
you know, whereas as other people are able to learn from each one and other people don't have beef with either one, these guys are like, I hate that guy. I hate that.
This one. This is what I was talking about with the dueling banjos. It's uh-huh. like these two guys are almost they're like oil and water.
Mm-hmm.
And they're both world changers, right? They're both. I mean, you could say that they're both chaos agents, but for very different reasons. They both have this massive impact on the story, for different motives and in different ways.
Yeah. Agreed. Even though Melkor's in it a lot longer than Feanor, the legacy of Feanor stretches maybe even longer than Melkor.
What's the line earlier here? Where to go? The courses of Feanor would have been otherwise, and great evil might have been prevented. For the sorrow and the strife in the House of Finwë is graven in the memory of the Noldorian elves. That's a heavy statement.
Well, and for everyone who wants to give Feanor a free pass, if he would have just held his craft a little bit more lightly, this might have been averted. But it was sort of that guarded, almost selfish, singular focus that kind of kept Melkor out of his business as well, right?
Yeah. Feanor, made a lot of decisions that we're going to get to in the next chapter. But they start here, right? Just this isolation, this refusal to work with his peers, this refusal to take advice. But then the one person that everybody liked and he was against, he was actually right on. And that's why he's such a complicated character, is like he did get some things right, but then he got some things also so wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you do with that guy? You can't really put him neatly into a box. And I like how you brought that up. You know, it's something that people like to talk about Martin's gray characters and how Tolkien doesn't have them, but he totally does. They're not as prominent in The Lord of the Rings, but they're very prominent in The Silmarillion.
Well, and also, I mean, I don't know how much love Christopher Tolkien gets on this podcast, but
and we love Christopher. I think that
the naming of this book really weights this story differently.
Mm-hmm.
If this story was named like A History of the Beginnings of Middle Earth and the Surrounding Territories or something like that.
Right.
You might miss the importance of Feanor. I don't know. There's something seminal here. There's something, some sort of generative force here that really pushes the rest of the book going forward.
So as far as naming the Silmarillion, I totally agree with you. You know, making you, it sort of signals to the readers, track the Silmarils. That's what's going to be the driving force in this story. And I think Tolkien wanted to call it the Silmarillion when he was trying to publish it. Because I don't know how much you know about the publication history, but basically he was trying to publish this alongside The Lord of the Rings.
Sure.
For a really long time. And finally, a publisher agreed to do it. And then he said, never mind, I can't finish it. And that's what ended up happening. But he wanted to publish it as like a two-volume set of The Silmarillion, then The Lord of the Rings.
This was the mistake Martin made.
Yeah, go on.
He started publishing all of the background, histories of this, that, and the other thing.
He spent his, what is it, the Froa or the Hora or whatever? He spent his spirit out on the wrong stuff.
I almost want to break into tradition whenever we say the Froa and the Fea.
All right.
Sure.
You know, here's when I decided that Martin was probably not going to finish the books, is when he said, Well, if you asked J.R.R. Tolkien, he would have told you that the Silmarillion was his main work and he never finished that. And I was like, yep, he's decided not to finish this. That's it. That's it.
Write it off.
Well, I view this book as a gift. I think it, you know, sort of seeing it all put together, I feel like Christopher should get a lot of the credit for that.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah.
I think the book is not without its flaws.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's in desperate need of an editor.
It is.
And yet, if you stick with it, it's so rewarding. It's just some of the greatest storytelling ever in this book.
Agreed. Well, thank you, Anthony, for being with us here on this discussion of Tolkien. It's so nice to talk to you about another franchise. We've done Andor, we've done Game of Thrones, and now here we are with the Silmarillion.
Mm-hmm.
Where can people find you?
They cannot. I'm a ghost. I cannot be found. But if you like sort of chapter by chapter rereads, Electric Boogaloo under the House of the Dragon feed, we're going through Clash of Kings, and another amazing storyteller, George R.R. Martin. So
yeah,
that's sort of the project I've been working on of late. Although in the near future, look for my podcast covering the Apple show Severance.
Very cool. All right. We'll leave a link to that in the show notes. Anthony, thank you so much again for being here with us. Always a pleasure talking to you.
Absolutely.
So let's take a quick break, and then when we get back, we'll continue our conversation.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.
And we're back.
All right, David, that was a great conversation with Maester Anthony. Always a pleasure speaking with him.
Very thoughtful. We always have such good, meaty conversations when we have a conversation with him. I enjoy
totally.
It. Yeah.
Totally. But for now, we have to talk to some other people because we have listener feedback. Would you like to read some of those?
Okay, first up is a Lore Master Patreon subscriber, Eric F., who sent in two emails, not one, but two. His first email is about a topic that came up from an earlier one where we were talking about Gilgamesh. Eric says, "Hi, guys. I may be late. However, my understanding of the pronunciation of the name of Gilgamesh's friend, as I've always heard it pronounce it, is as Enkidu, with the emphasis on the second syllable. Whether this is right or wrong, that's the way I've always heard it. And as a result, I've always pronounced it just FYI." Who knows? I am a notorious, what do you call somebody who's bad at pronunciation?
A mispronouncer? I don't know.
I'm a notorious mispronouncer. So I don't know if I have the right syllable or not, but we can go with Enkidu.
The emphasis on the wrong syllable, right?
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Gilgamesh and Enkidu are great Babylonian, back to the Babylonian times, very stories about a number of mythological topics. So,
yeah. Cool. Well, thanks for writing in with that, Eric.
So Eric did send us a second email, says, "Hey guys, did some research on the possible inspirations of Tulkas. Tulkas. I ran across the following, and just to give proper credit, it was written by a Quora user by the name of Meldon Tarnayon.
Tarnayon, yeah. Who knows?
So this is a quote of a quote of a quote kind of thing. Tulkas is a cleaned up version of Thor, and by cleaned up, I intend a version of the harsh and unforgiving North mythology that is somehow harmonized with Christian theology. So the Aesir's become biblical angels, utterly pure in their disposition towards good or evil, and not stained with human defects as Greek and Norse gods instead were. So, talking about Thor Tulkas, he has a physical prowess and love for strength contests. Also, he is not the sharpest knife in the drawer, and he is terrible in his wrath, a primeval creature of natural forces who does not value weapons, unlike Thor, we must say. But giving Tulkas a hammer would have been too much, I think.
Yeah, a little too on the nose.
Strategy and thinking in general. The similarities with Hercules are legitimate, but that is because the North mythology and the Greek ones have a common Indo-European source. They are branches of the same tree, and Thor and Hercules share many aspects, and they're probably the same original concept expressed in two civilizations very distant from one another in time and space. However, Tolkien, even being erudite in ancient Greek language and literature, took Northern myths as his major source of inspiration. Found this interesting. Thought you might want to know. Eric.
Yeah. Yeah, he did. The Kalevala, he was super into. You know, he would always look at these at Norse mythology and other Indo-European mythologies. He wanted to read it. He would actually have like book clubs where they would sit around in a circle and each read it in foreign languages, read different ancient poems in the foreign languages. And that was his little book club outing, which is an insane outing, right? But you can totally see this stuff showing up in his writing. When we get to of Turin Turambar, you're going to see a lot more Norse stuff coming through. I guarantee you. And Marilyn will be there with us for that in August 2024.
She's already pre-claimed that one.
Right. Interesting. So thanks for writing in with that. Yeah.
Well, to go back to this common source thing and the strong male figure who's into, you know, feats of strength and adventuring and all that kind of stuff, that goes back to Gilgamesh and Enkidu. Where Gilgamesh was a king and he was civilized, Enkidu was a wild man who was raised by wild beasts, and then they became friends, and Gilgamesh sort of civilized him.
You got Samson in Jewish theology,
right? So it's going back to this Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, in my mind's eye, looking like person, you know, fit and very beefy and just with a real choix de vie, you know, hey, I'm strong, I can do stuff in the world, let me go out and run around and have some fun. So if that goes back to some common roots, I am certainly not enough of a scholar to answer that question, but I think Eric brings up some interesting thoughts.
Yeah.
So thanks, Eric, for writing in.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. Next up, we've got Tom S. by email. The subject line of the email was an LOTR essay.
So buckle up.
Right. Well, I'm not going to read all of it. It was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 paragraphs. We're going to stick to the salient parts. And Tom, just so you know, I'll write back to you on a couple of other points directly so that we can answer some of the questions and things that you've said. But Tom starts off, I'm relatively new patron, but I've been following you both since the start. Your background episodes for Rings of Power, Second Age were perfect for refreshing my memory and getting ready for the TV show, which incidentally, I just started a rewatch of. I then ended up going and reading, listening to Silmarillion audiobooks. It's one of my favorites, so I was really pleased to hear you going through month by month. The Einar Lindele is one of my favorite pieces of writing ever! !
There's something about the Einar Lindele that it's just its own vibe. You know, when I first read that, and look, I'm not saying the Silmarillion can't be hard to get through in parts, but when I first read that, it just felt like I was transported to another world. Like the description of the music of the Ainur is so visceral and so vivid that it just, every time it gets
you. Yeah, you're getting got right now, I can tell.
Yeah.
All right, so carrying on with Tom's email, I'm super excited for season 2 of The Wheel of Time. Oh, this is a slightly tangential, but kind of connected to this podcast. Excited for season 2 of Wheel of Time. Now we've got a release date and hoping very much that you two will be covering it. We are, and we will have full coverage. We're working out our strategies now, and we will announce those in due course. Continues, I am currently rereading for maybe the 10th time.
I'm impressed. over a million words. I mean,
that's wow. A lot.
Yeah.
The series along with another podcast and have just finished book 10. Shout out to The Wheel Weaves. If you guys are familiar with them, is that a podcast you
listen to? I'm not familiar. I haven't delved too deeply into Wheel of Time podcasts.
Okay. I'm sure there are a plethora of them out there.
Yeah.
Would love to hear all of your thoughts about it. And if you can sell Marilyn on reading one of them as well, I might overheat from excitement, but it would be great to listen to. Maybe a season one recap? We are demanding.
Here's my thing about Marilyn reading one is if I tell her to read the first one, she's going to hate it because it's a Tolkien clone. And it's not going to be as good as Tolkien. And she's going to hate it for that reason. It's
a praise.
And I won't blame her. I will not blame her for it. However, if I got her to read book two, I think I could sell her on it.
Okay.
Well, but you got to read book one to get to book two. That's the problem.
We know you're listening. And we know that Tom is listening to your listening. So yeah. There you go.
We demand an answer. That's what Tom says.
All right. So relevant question for Lord of the or Silmarillion stories. You mentioned in an earlier background podcast for Rings of Power about the idea of Fëa and Hroa. I have read the Silmarillion about 3 times and Lord of the Rings a few times, but never delved deeper into the legendarium. I'm wondering if you could explain a bit more of what these mean, how they relate to magic and how they relate to magic systems. Do the elves deplete or expend their Fëa by doing magic? And with their great axe, are the two the same? And does that relate to producing a child? It seems to be finite. Fëanor being twice an example, creating the Silmarils was something he could not replicate. And when his mother gave birth, she used up too much of her spirit to produce any more children or even sustain her own life. Is producing a child for elves akin to magic? I'm now spiraling off into elven immaculate conception, but I'll leave that there. This may not be a clear answer, as I've heard the term soft magic system used for Tolkien. I'm a hard magic system fan, hence Wheel of Time. I'd be interesting to know anything about elvish reproduction and pregnancy, but I guess that's something Tolkien, that's not something Tolkien would write about.
You are guessing wrong. Boy, did he go into it. If you want to read more of this, by the Nature of Middle Earth, which is the most recent, I think, of the posthumous books. And it was not compiled by Christopher. I think it was after Christopher's death, too. But it combines a lot of unfinished writings of Tolkien. And boy, did this guy go into every detail you could possibly want. I just actually pulled up the outline of the elf chapter that we did for the Second Age, because I compiled all this from Nature of Middle Earth. And so here's some details. So you've got the Hroa and the Fëa, the body and the spirit. We talked about that earlier in this podcast with Anthony. But basically, to make a child, you need to expend some Hroa. And your Hroa is always fading. So early in life is when you have to make a child. Otherwise, you're just not going to have the Hroa to do it. Anyway, so an expanding Hroa is basically the Elvish version of aging. You know, that's your body fading. Your Fëa doesn't fade. Your Fëa is where it's at, and your Fëa is what exists when your body fades and you have that elvish death. Your Fëa is immortal. It's your body that can't last forever. Now, as far as magic, having a child isn't magic. It's just they have to expend their energy to do it. And the elves generally can only have like 2 or 3 kids at the most. That's why having 7 sons of Fëanor was clearly a direct result of him having so much Hroa from his mother in him. As far as everyday magic, you know, the sort of, you know, the waters and things like that, that is different from the great works, as you created that distinction. The great works like the Silmarils, you need to expend a bunch of body energy for that. As far as ordinary things like what Elrond does, that's not magic in the way that it's like I'm casting a spell. That's, as I was saying to Anthony, that's more of molding reality with reality. You are going with the flow of nature. You're not against it. You're seeing the deeper truth of nature and using that to manipulate it, but almost with it. It's this very naturopathic magic that Tolkien is imputing to the elves.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so that does not, to my understanding, that does not expend Hroa, because you're not really doing anything. You're just vibing with nature. You're resonating with nature.
Okay. Singing to the waters.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Pregnancy. He also goes into that. It is about the same as men. It's like 3/4 of a year. But because elvish years are like 144 man years, it's like 108-year pregnancy, which is crazy. And I should mention, this is not all universal. There's debate within the writings of how deep you wanted to go into this ratio of men to elves and years. So I won't say that this is absolute truth, but if you want to read all his different opinions on it, I would definitely recommend The Nature of Middle Earth.
There you go. There is your answers.
Yeah, a lot of them. And if that was too much, I am sorry.
It's Tolkien. It's always a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Tom, for writing in. And as I said, I'll email you back with a couple of other things, because you had a few other questions that weren't necessarily Tolkien related. So that's all the feedback we have for this episode. Again, if you've got thoughts, comments, questions, send them into us at lotr@thelorehounds.com.
Oh, hold on now. There's a final thought from Tom.
Yes. Okay. Please, why don't you do
the honors? Ooh, arugula forever.
We need that on a t-shirt.
I know. We gotta get on our merch game, and I think Eru Arugula is perfect for that.
Yes. Coming after the our 1 year, we'll start working on that. We got
plans. Yep.
Hot takes for your hot cakes, coffee mug, a Woogula t-shirt. Yeah, it's coming. So hang in there.
Yep.
But anyway, yes, lotr@thelorehounds.com, or head over to our website, use contact form or voicemail. And we have a Tolkien channel set up on our Discord server, so you can talk all things Tolkien there. John, quick thanks to our Patreon subscribers, if you would be so kind.
Sure. So we've got our top patrons are our lore masters. We're thankful to all our patrons, but especially our lore masters, who get a special shout out every episode as part of their benefits. Samartian, Cyrus, Mark H, Michael G, Michelle E, David W, Brian P, Nick W, SC, Peter OH, Bettina W, Adam S, Nancy M, Lavinia T, Duve 71, Brian 8063, Frederick H, Sarah L, Gareth C, Eric F, Matthew M, Sarah M, DJ Miwa, Joyce E, and Andra B. Thank you all so much. You know, we are currently going for our 1 year anniversary, trying to get to 100 patrons. We're at about 80 right now. Andra was our 80th. And what we're doing at the end of July is anyone who's a patron at that time is going to get mailed an anniversary sticker that you can't get anywhere else. We're not going to put this up for sale.
Yep.
or anything. This is going to be yours for being with us early. That's yours, right, for being an early adopter here on the Patreon.
Yeah.
As a thank you. And so double check. We've been mentioning this every podcast, but if you do want it in the mail, double check that Patreon has your mailing address. I think most people do put that in, but some people don't. And if you don't want us to mail you something, totally fine. We'll send you an e-card. We'll send you an e-sticker, and you can print it out if you want. So, David, would you like to talk about just a couple programming notes?
Yeah, just a reminder, check out Anthony's podcast, Electric Boogaloo. There'll be a link in the show notes, or just search for Electric Boogaloo. He gets some really great guests on there. It's a fun thing. Also, we have Alicia, who you may have heard. She's chimed in on some of our Star Wars stuff. She's now a full co-host on our MC Universe podcast. She has her own podcast that we're the proud publishing sponsors for. It's called Wool Shift Dust, and it's all about the Silo TV show on Apple Plus. It's a very cool sci-fi dystopian mystery box show, and her co-host Luke break down every episode. and get into the books and the shows. It's great. So we're very happy to have her running that. A couple of things since we're at the end of June, we'll have our July schedule out pretty soon, but a couple of things to keep in mind for the future. We're covering every Star Wars film in story order. So we've done A Phantom Menace. What's next, John, is you're the prequel trilogy.
Yeah, Attack of the Clones.
Thank you, Attack of the Clones. But more importantly, Ahsoka is coming up on Disney. So with the start of the Ahsoka TV show, there's a lot of background material, and not unlike the Rings of Power with Lord of the Rings, we decided that we would do a little prep podcast. So we're going to be getting into who Ahsoka Tano is, what's her backstory, so that if you are not deep into the animated Star Wars universe, you'll have some context for what you're going to be seeing in that TV show. And we've got our fingers and our toes crossed that that's going to be a great show. I'm getting excited for it. So
me too. Yeah. Every trailer seems to look better.
So. Yeah.
Yeah.
The other two big things that we're going to be covering this year are Foundation, which is going to come back on Apple TV, which is, I think, inspired by the Isaac Asimov books. I don't know that we can say that they're an adaptation per se, because they've had to do a lot to change them.
I got
to
say, I'm going to go off on a tiny tangent here.
Yeah.
There was a podcast I was listening to recently about the Wheel of Time series, and it was with Brandon Sanderson, who wrote the last three Wheel of Time books. And he was saying that he sees adaptations as falling into two categories. One is the faithful adaptation, mm-hmm. and one is the inspired by adaptation. And they're like both valid, and they both have pros and cons. And he actually sees the Wheel of Time as somewhere in the middle. But I think you're right. Foundation is probably more of that inspired by.
I like that. I think we'll have to add that to our Shippy test, and we'll have a little bit of a matrix there to be able to gauge some of these things. Yeah, that's cool. And then lastly, and of course, Wheel of Time, we will be covering that in full once it starts to air later this year. So, John, I think that's what's our next chapter in the Silmarillion stories?
Next chapter is...
Don't you have these memorized?
Of the Silmarils and the Ooh. Unrest of the Noldor.
So that sounds exciting. Sounds like we might get some things happening there.
I know. Every month we go, things are going to happen next month. And then we have like a little bit more setup because that's just the way it goes. But we're rocking now. You know, the Silmarils are here, so we're rocking now. Don't worry.
It's time to start. All right. Well, thanks everyone for sticking around. And we look forward to our next chapter. Until then.
The Lorehounds podcast is produced and published by The Lorehounds. You can send questions and feedback and voicemails at thelorehounds.com/contact. Get early and ad-free access to all Lorehounds podcasts at patreon.com/thelorehounds. Any opinions stated are ours personally and do not reflect the opinion of or belong to any employers or other entities. Thanks for listening.
Lord Vader, Operation Andor is underway.
Excellent. If we release 3 episodes per week, the Lorehounds will never be able to cover every episode. The Imperial forces will crush the rebellion before it begins.
Stand by. We're picking up something on our scanners.
Echo Squadron, reporting in.
Delta Squadron, on your left.
Django Squadron, on your 6.
With Imperial forces coming in fast, we're calling all Rebels to join the fight this season. Starting after the April 22nd premiere, you'll hear 3 full breakdowns for each week's episodes of Andor Season 2. Each podcast will be led by one of our squadron leaders, Alicia, David, and John. We'll be bringing in new and familiar voices to fill out the roster. Search for the Lorehounds on any podcast platform to join us in a galaxy far, far away. And don't forget to check out our season pass for even more content like our Holocron bonus pods. It's good news for anyone, except Darth Vader.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the Roaring Twenties. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.